Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Gorgeous Lives. Today, we have Jane Hayward, author of The Baby Box. And I'm going to allow Jane to introduce us to the story, which is a memoir of The Baby Box. Welcome, Jane.
Hello, it's very nice to be here and to talk about the book, of course. The story of The Baby Box is about the relationship and the deterioration of the relationship between me and my mother during 3 years of the mid-1960s. But it hangs on the fact that I was pregnant while I was still at school, and my mother was not overwhelmingly delighted about it, to say the least. That's the basis of what the book is, but it does take us right through the difficult period and then on into the mother and baby home, which I thoroughly enjoyed. So forget anything to do with very bad and sad mother and baby homes, because mine was wonderful.
I have to say, it was a very beautifully descriptive book. I really enjoyed your language. And of course, it had personal resonance for me, which you can't know, was that I was adopted in 1967 in New York, of course. So it had particular resonance for me. But take us back to that time. You were quite young. You were when you got pregnant.
Yes, we moved up to London when I was 16, and I met the father of the baby-to-be, as it were, at a New Year's Eve party the following year. And by the end of that summer, I was pregnant. I thought, obviously, that everything was going to go quite well, that my mother and father would be understanding. I was in a permanent relationship, you know, he said he loved me. And the reason that the book comes over to be so lively, as it were, is because I'm very lucky in that I can remember everything. I can remember what people said. I can remember the sounds and the sights and the atmosphere of a room. And so as long as I don't stop to think too much, I just write it down and edit it later, then that goes on the page. So I think that explains this voice. It is my voice. And I haven't tried to elaborate or change it in any way.
Yes, it does feel very, very vivid, including, you know, I mean, meals that your mother would make. Please describe to us the sort of atmosphere, because hormones are hormones. Hormones haven't changed,
No.
So how you got pregnant is no surprise to any of us.
No.
And nor should it have been to your parents, truly. But the time was very different. Let's go back to that time when you got pregnant, what the atmosphere was like at school and the social background, because your parents moved to London. Tell us a bit about that, because that was maybe a little bit unusual at that time.
Well, my parents moved to London from Hertfordshire because my father had got promotion. And up until all of that time, they had lived with my father's mother. So there was a mother-in-law issue at home, which I think made my mother very unhappy. And when we reached Streatham, it was a nice house, it was in a fairly good area. They thought they'd arrived. You know, they'd got their three children with them. They didn't have mother-in-law. They had this beautiful new house. They went out and bought new furniture, and they thought everything was perfect. And of course, then within about 6 or 7 months, I ruined it for them. So I do have a great deal of sympathy for my mother. I think perhaps it would have been nice if she couldn't have been quite so hard, but nevertheless, I understand the situation. I think it's very hard for people to put their minds right back to what life was like. We are talking over 50 years ago now. I've had some odd comments from friends of my age who have said, why didn't you have an abortion? Because it wasn't legal. Why weren't you on the pill? Because you couldn't get it. You couldn't get it from married mothers even by the time I was married in 1968, you know. But the atmosphere was very similar in all middle-class homes, that nice girls didn't have sex before they got married. And my mother had a particular problem with me growing up, which I mentioned right at the beginning of the book, I think. The minute I reached puberty, she was really down on me. I think she was scared of what might happen, which, of course, exaggerates her feelings when it does happen. But certainly any arrangement that any of my other friends had was kept very secret, extremely secret, and nobody talked about it, nobody asked about it. The first school I was at was very strict, no talking in the corridors, all that kind of stuff. And then I moved to London and went to a school on Clapham Common, And the first thing was that we didn't have to wear uniform. We could wear anything as long as it was navy blue. And secondly, the girls there were just so different from they were in the country. And I do have one in my book, different name, of course, called Rita. And she was on the game. She didn't have any money. She just said to the blokes, you can have it, but it's a new pair of boots. Or it's a this, a leather jacket. And I was both fascinated and slightly appalled until I went into her home, which I also use in the book. And then I understood and I liked her. She was very bright. She knew exactly what she was going to do when she left school. And we got on very well. And she became my friend. So I was adjusting my ideas to the world, as it were, in London pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And I think that played a little bit of a part in my decision not to be quite so fussy about adhering to the rules.
Radio Gorgeous, created by women for women. RadioGorgeous.com.
It's a time in anyone's life when we are at our most conformist and wanting to fit in. And so whoever's in your purview seems cool, seems like the right person, but fine, sold. And they know more than I do. A little country girl. Yeah. Tell me one thing, because it's a memoir and it's your story, you get to leave in and leave out. But one thing I'm curious about is that you say you're one of three siblings. Where do you come in that lineup?
I'm the eldest.
Okay.
The next one down is my brother, who was 3 years younger than me. So when I was 16, he was only 13. And then there were 2 years before Martin came along. When I wrote the memoir, I thought it is a structured memoir. Mm-hmm. It's written in dramatic narrative, so it keeps the tension going. And to put two people who actually didn't play any part at all in the drama, because they were always at school. And I'm sure my mother wouldn't have behaved half as sort of angrily if the boys had been in the house. And I honestly can't remember, and this is the curious thing about memory, any time when they were in the house with me and my mother. I don't remember the meal times when they were there, but they clearly were there. They're just not there. So I took the decision to simply leave them out.
Do you think that's in part because your mother wanted to seal off the infection, as it were?
I mean, boys, you mean?
Yes, and no, they weren't girls, no. But, you know, sort of seal off the...
I think my younger brother was a very keen ice skater. And, of course, it was a fantastic rink at Streatham. I think he was out most of the time ice skating. The other one, I don't really know what he did. He was probably late home from school, hung about a bit. And then possibly went out in the evening. But I wasn't the slightest bit interested in either of them. Mm. So, you know, it just didn't register in the memory bank. And that's the best I can do on that one. But other people have mentioned it and assumed I was an only child.
Yes.
And thought that's why there was so much pressure on me. But it wasn't that. It was simply that I had done the one thing that you're not supposed to do.
And why do you think, this is jumping, because in the book you make some theories about why your mother had reacted in the way that she did, because it did seem rather extreme. If you would describe your relationship before you got pregnant, before the move and things began to change.
Well, it began to change, as I said, when I was about 13, and she had a go at me about my posture. And then I went to Woolworths and bought a lipstick, you know, and she went absolutely ballistic. Oddly enough, I was allowed eye makeup. She never, ever objected. Bit of shadow, bit of mascara, no problem. And for many, many things, she was very good at that. She encouraged me to go and use her night cream every night before I went to bed. But anything where I'd stepped over the line towards the being a bit tarty, which was a big word in those days, you know, you do something as tarty, that got her disapproval. And in fact, one Easter holiday, I can't remember what I did, but I was locked up for the whole of the Easter holiday. I do remember that. And I wasn't very old, 13, 14. And I think resentment began to set in at that point. And of course, she never would discuss. Obviously, she told me the facts of life before I went off to the grammar school, because you've been told that's what should happen. But she didn't exactly spell it out. So I actually learnt the real facts from girls at school, as you do. But if I had suggested anything to her, like discussing whether or not, you know, how far you let your boyfriend go and all that kind of thing, absolutely shut down. So there was no way I could go to say to her, look, I want to sleep with X, you know, I couldn't have done it.
And yet, inexplicably to me, I guess maybe your mother was trying to, you could see the gulf widening between you and was perhaps trying to sort of bridge it in some way. When you started seeing your boyfriend, there was a moment you were allowed to go to his house across town and sleep over.
Simply because she said, we are trusting you. And of course, I thought, that's fine. Yeah, you will be able to trust me, wildly, naively. On the other hand, I bet there was a little niggle in the back of my head that thought, actually, probably not. But I don't remember my attitude when I was going over there, other than that I was really looking forward to it. Also partly because my boyfriend lived in a very good address and I was expecting this amazing house and we were going to go to parties in amazing places. That bit happened, the parties, but what I was expecting was nothing like what I expected. And it didn't make any difference to my attitude towards him. It was just simply another thing. I thought, I can't tell my mother this because she will, that will be it, you know, because yes, getting because on was so important to her. It was just vastly important to her because they had, in my generation, your parents got on or didn't during the war. And what happened during the war coloured the rest of their lives, you know. So she was different from all her sisters and all
what
this kind of thing.
What happened during the war to her?
Well, she went into the WAF and she met all sorts of interesting people. One of the Mitford, I think it's Jessica Mitford, was, you know, one of the Mitford girls was part of her set. And so quite flashy people. And she talked to all the officers and she decided she could be an officer. So she went and knocked on the door and said, I'd like to be an officer. So she became an officer. And she was then with Churchill on Codes and Ciphers. So, you know, really quite a glamorous life, even though there was a war going on. And she ended up in Italy when the peace was signed. And my father had been invalided out because he had a knife through his chin or something. And they met in Italy. And they married and they lived for 2 years, this idyllic life of, you know, living in Italy. And Mum would talk to me about that and she made friends with a woman whose house they were living in and all this business and learned how to cook. She was an amazing cook. And then they got home and her life fell apart for the first time to discover mother-in-law. And then she got over that. And then her life fell apart second time because of what I'd done. You know, I've never really blamed her for what happened, but it was nice to get away from it.
Radio Gorgeous, online, on your phone, on a podcast, or on your tablet. Listen anywhere, anytime.
And am I correct in thinking that she was different from her sisters in that she was sent away when she was young?
No, that was perfectly normal. Mum was the middle sister. So, yeah, she was sent away to live with her grandmother. And when she came home at the age of 14, and she'd won the, she was the first person in her family to win an academic scholarship to the grammar school, Hastings Grammar. And her mother said, now you're going out to work. I found your job. You're going to be a nanny to these two children, you know. And my mother apparently said, well, what about my schooling, you know, and you signed a piece of paper. And Gran said, never mind the piece of paper, you're going out to work. And everybody went out to work at the age of 14, of course, except the last two of her siblings, which were boys, and they went to Hastings Grammar and were allowed to stay on. So three of them kind of escaped that routine life where you never really get, you know, any better, for want of a better word. And I think that was partly, I think it explains a lot about her personality and how it developed. And it must have been very hard at 14 to be suddenly thrown out and she was sleeping in the loft or in the attic with the cold tank, you know, and everything. You can hardly imagine it now.
I was interested in the parallels because you were sent to the mother and baby's home. I was thinking of the parallels of being separated from your family
at
that
time.
At
one point, yeah.
And how you repeat those things over time. The worst thing that happened to you that you're going to not ever do, there you go doing it. Yeah. Let's get to that part. I wanted to know who Fiona was in your lives, because she seems to be a person that your mother respected and that you liked and was sort of like the good fairy god aunt, you know, that would come into your house and you would come up with solutions and creative and et cetera. Tell me a bit about that relationship.
Well, I think she was. She was someone that Mum met in the war and continued her friendship with her. And I think she was genuinely interested in me. As far as I know, she never married. She was a bit of a flighty person. Mum admitted that, you know, she's a bit of a flighty person. In fact, I think that comes into the book in the first half, doesn't it? I liked her. I enjoyed her visits. They were glamorous. She was a very glamorous woman. And I thought she would help me because I thought she'd understand. And of course, she did in a way, because I suspect, you know, that's... I never really actually knew how they knew about the mother and baby home, but I suspect it was Fiona. And she was a fixer. She was in my, you know, in my life, she was the most glamorous and this is what you attain to be person. And I think my mother kept in touch with her because she was glamorous and of a slightly different world.
Mm. And she came up with the solution that you would go to the mother and baby
home. I'm pretty sure, yeah. Mm.
And decisions are being made for you.
Yeah.
And in your name. In your mind, you're going to get married. Despite being underage, you're going to get married.
Well, I'm not underage to that extent. I could get married, but I was underage. It was 21. I think we need to remind ourselves of that too. 21 was the age of consent.
Yeah. So you did need your parents' permission to get married.
Yes.
Yeah. Which they were not quite willing to do.
Absolutely not.
And they also decided for you.
Yeah.
That it would be a path to adoption.
Yes.
And in all of this, I'm not surprised your relationship suffered because you were never heard.
No. No. And interestingly, I've found one or two things while I've been writing this book. In fact, they could not have, actually I mentioned this in the book, they could not have adopted the baby without my consent. Not that anybody told me that until it was a way down the path. They could send me without my consent to the mother and baby home because I was obviously under the age of consent for anything. They could also withdraw money. They could do all those things that they wanted to do. I'm rapidly trying to think whether there was anybody else in the home who had literally been sent, but there were. There definitely were. It was pretty 50-50 who was sent and who volunteered to go because that's what would be the best thing in the long run, you know. Yeah.
And sort of like prison, you feared the mother and baby home.
No, I didn't.
You didn't.
No.
Oh, right.
No, I had somebody who was reading the proof for me or the graft and she came back and said I'd like a bit more trepidation during that journey. And I said, but I wasn't. I said I was longing to get out of the house.
Yes, escaping mom and dad. Yeah.
I was going to a part of London I didn't know. And I suppose this is very me. I was just fascinated to know what it was going to be like. And although there was that little moment when Mum left me, when I thought, you know, and what did I do? You know, I had a good look about who was there in the room. And I loved every single minute of it. I mean, I had unhappy moments, don't get me wrong. I mean, there were times when I went to bed in tears, but the whole process of being there. And I think the matron helped. She was wonderful. Because my husband said, you know, Mrs. Clements comes over as a saint. I said, well, frankly, she was.
Yes, because everyone else took the opportunity. Almost everyone else took the opportunity. And I think this was, you know, in the Irish mother and baby homes, was a big theme. Mm. Took the opportunity to shame you.
Yes.
You know, but whereas that didn't happen in your mother and baby home, the girls were different. They seemed more informed than you, it has to be said.
I mean, there were some who had been sent because their father said, just get out, girl, I don't want to see you anymore. And there were one or two that were more mature. I was quite surprised. And they were doing everything off their own bat because they realised. I think the main point to make at this stage is that we were all convinced. Perhaps I wasn't quite so convinced because I still had high hopes of the father of the baby coming up with a solution. But they were all convinced that the best thing for the baby was to have him or her adopted. And the love and everything that was in that home and in the baby room was it was just fantastic. And when their letters, I'll probably have a little cry at this point, when their letters arrived and said it with the date to go, they just rushed from the room, you know, with the tears streaming down their face. And everybody understood it. And so that was a sad moment. But then the making of the baby box, I mean, perhaps I should explain this because people have asked me. The baby box was a very big old cardboard carton, like you have packets of cornflakes in, lots of packets. And the mother would cover it with appropriate baby wrapping paper and the appropriate colour ribbon, pink or blue. And then on the morning that they were going to leave, everything went into the box, the nappies, the clothes, everything the baby had. Well, teddy bear, everything.
Well, and also you guys had spent your time knitting and making clothes for the baby.
Well, I did. I'm not sure everybody knitted as much as me, but certainly I had a massive wardrobe. Yes.
To send off with these babies.
Yeah, to send off.
And so the mothers would bring the baby in the baby box and then leave.
Yeah,
and then
the social worker would pick them up and they would be in a room and the new parents were in the next room and they'd hand their baby over. But they knew what they were doing. There wasn't anything of let the other parents have a quick look and see. You know, interestingly, there was a programme, it was one of these detective programmes on television recently where all of this was going on. But they actually had the mothers could approve which babies they had. Now, there was none of that. You know, I presume you could choose a girl or a boy. But apart from that, you got the next one on the list. So that all went. It went smoothly. It was sad because everybody felt sad that morning. But the atmosphere, we were talking about atmosphere earlier, and the atmosphere in the home that morning was quiet. Nobody went in the hall when she was leaving, the mum. Nobody talked about it because everybody knew that's what they were facing.
And your experience was different from that.
Yes. I don't want to talk too much about the end because it's a plot spoiler.
Exactly.
The tension is important. Exactly.
But I wanted to ask you why, because you are a fiction writer, why you didn't fictionalize this?
I did to begin with. Mm-hmm. I started writing it years ago when Mum was still alive. And my mother has been dead 17 years now. And I fictionalized it to distance. Because you can't write novels if you're distancing. It doesn't work. But I continued with the novel idea for a long time, partly because I didn't feel capable of dealing with such a thing as this morning, you know. And I sent it, my final send round was to 48 agents. And one was good enough to reply. And my pitch was, look, it can be a novel or a memoir. What are you looking for? Well, 47 of them or even 48 of them weren't looking for anything. But one replied, this struggles not to be a memoir. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's it. So I will rewrite it in my voice, putting a bit more in, a bit more reflection about how I felt rather than making it up. And it will be a memoir. And it went very smoothly. I just needed someone to push me and say, this is what you should be doing, you know.
RadioGorgeous.com.
I also thought it was a way to honour.
Yes, and also...
what happened
and
the people involved.
Yeah, and also
because to fictionalise it sort of denies their existence.
Exactly that. I agree with you entirely, although I probably hadn't worked that out until I'd finished it. And then, of course, there is the question, I'm quite happy to talk about this, which is that very last brief chapter where I tried to ring up the call-in programme and broke down. I couldn't do it. And I just thought, this poor man, you know, he really needs to know the truth. Sadly, I'm not reaching those people, but, you know, I can't help that. I do my best.
And what point in your life, I'm interested to know, because it took you a long time to sort of understand some of your mother's motivations at that time. Mm. And especially at that time in our lives as teenagers, we don't think of our parents as people.
No.
They are the arbiters of our existence. Mm. They are irritants. Mm. They are jailers. Mm. They're assholes. You know, whatever they are. But they're not people in the full sense of the word.
Exactly.
At what point did you tell your children about this part of your life?
That's a very good question because I didn't get on with my mother for quite a long time after I was married. We did see each other, but she was a great one for ringing up and either ticking me off or ticking my husband Peter off if she thought things weren't as they should be, you see. So at
one
point,
had a lot of rules about how things should be.
Yeah, she did. A lot of rules about how things should be. And there was one point when I think Peter was away and I was sitting talking to the children in the evening and I probably just had another spat with her over the phone. And Alice said, "Why is it that you always arguing with Granny, Mum?" And I thought, this has got to be it. I have to tell them. I can't really quite tell you how old they were. I did wonder whether Edward was old enough to take it. But I mean, he was quite mature for his age. And so I told them and they didn't say much. There was another occasion when Alice said, "I've been talking to Edward and we have an idea that we have a half-brother somewhere." So I didn't take any notice at that point. I thought, crumbs, that's weird. So I decided to tell them at that point. Peter obviously knew on our third date because I realised that this could go somewhere and I had to tell him quickly. His father was a Baptist minister. I mean, how dicey could you get? You know, they were all avant churchgoers and blah. So I told him very early on, and he's always been marvellous about it. But the actual deciding that I really would put it out there came, actually, I looked this up, and it was probably about 10 years ago now. And then, I won't go into details about this, because a lot of women will understand what I'm talking about. I had breast cancer. And that took 2 to 3 years out of my life. And I thought, we don't know when it's going to come back. Everyone's very honest about it. You need to do this like now. Get it out. Write it up. Tighten it. Do what you want, you know, and get it published. And never mind how you get it published, get it done. So I decided with Peter that we would do this. And the really quite awful irony of the whole thing is that the money that paid for the book was a present from my mother before she died. Can you believe that? But anyway, you know. Not, she won't know about it, so.
Well, congratulations. It is out there. Yeah. And it is a fascinating read. It's beautifully written. And as you say, it is a suspenseful page turner. We definitely want to know what happens to young Jane.
Thank you.
She's come good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And somebody asked me a little while ago on one of these telephone interviews whether the book had a happy ending. So I said, well, I'm happy now. Is that good enough?
Took a while, but here we are.
Here we are, yeah. Very excellent. Much, yeah.
Thank you so good. Much, Jane. And all the details about the book will be on our website.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you very much indeed.
And for more fascinating women, please go to www.radiogorgeous.com.